several months back, I traveled to speak at a Worldviews seminar up in Wisconsin. And before I left for the trip, my daughter asked me, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to go and talk about worldviews." And she gave me kind of the quizzical look of a 12-year-old girl and said, "What's a worldview?" It's a heck of a note. You know, we talk about this all the time on Issues, etc. And when pressed by an adolescent to answer the simple question, "What is a worldview?" I had to stop and think, now, how do I explain this? You see, we talk about worldviews a lot without using the word. And we are constantly immersed in our own worldview. We are constantly engaging other people's worldviews. We're going to start our conversation here on Issues, Etc. today with Joel Belts of World Magazine, answering that basic question. What is a worldview, and why does it matter that we are able to recognize what ours is and what others are as well? Joel Belts will join us here in just a few minutes here on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Alvin Schmidt will join us in 25 minutes, part 10 of our 11-part series on Islam. We're going to be talking with him about whether or not Islam is a religion of peace. This, of course, has been kind of the mantra for a while after September 11th that Islam is a religion of peace. Some people still believe it. We'll find out whether or not Islam itself corroborates that particular opinion about Islam. Dr. Alvin Schmidt will be our guest of Illinois College. Then, in the second hour of the program, an hour-long conversation with Dr. David Adams, occasioned by recent Barna research, saying that born-again Christians are just as likely to divorce as non-Christians. We're going to be talking about divorce. What does the Bible have to say about divorce? Is there such a thing as a scriptural divorce? And what does the church do when, by and large, not only the culture, but also, the church has abandoned Scripture's teaching on divorce? Dr. David Adams will be our guest. Then, in the third hour of the program, two guests. Dr. David Maxwell will join us from Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. We'll talk about the saint that is remembered today by the church on its calendar, Jerome, translator of Holy Scripture. That'll be the conversation there. Then, in the last 25 minutes, Dr. Jeff Waltz of Concordia University, Wisconsin, will join us to talk about presidential debates. Of course, tonight is the first of several presidential debates in this election cycle. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Joel Belts is publisher and founder of World Magazine. He will be speaking at a conference this Friday and Saturday at Center Grove Presbyterian Church in Edwardsville on the subject of worldviews. He joins us to talk about the same subject. Joel, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hey, thank you. I'm intrigued that your daughter picked up on that topic and kind of nailed you with it, didn't she?
Well, yes, she did. Yeah. I did come up with an answer, but I'd like your answer to that question. What is a worldview?
I like to think of it as which pair of glasses do you pick up to look through? Do you pick up dark glasses? Do you pick up clear glasses? Do you pick up rose-colored glasses? Because the glasses you pick up will affect how you see the world. And we all, as we grow up, pick up different pairs of glasses along the way. And we do it very unintentionally. We do it very quietly. We probably don't realize we're doing it, but as we go along, we pick. Some people look at everything materialistically. Some people look at everything lustfully. Some people look at everything in a United States perspective, and so on.
James Sire, he's been on the show several times and was recently on. We talked about his book called, his latest is called Naming the Elephant. And it's kind of a follow-up on his first, The Universe Next Door, that introduced most people that I know to the concept of the worldview. How would you break it down? He breaks it down into about four or five different worldviews. How would you break down the basic palette of worldviews that we would find in the 21st century today?
I guess I'd be a little more simplistic than Dr. Sire, and I would say that I'd start with two. One, you look at things supernaturally. And second, you look at things naturally. You look at things either as if God is at the center of the universe and all of his creation, or you look at everything out there as if human beings are at the center of the creation. And that choice is pretty profound.
Now, to go into a little more detail here, Joel, someone might say, fine, we have basically an atheistic or a materialistic worldview and a theistic worldview. Does that mean that within the theistic worldview, the worldviews of, say, Christians and Muslims are identical to one another?
Not identical, but they are, odd as it may seem, they are off on the same journey, aren't they? Because at least they're together in saying, no, man is not the measure of all things. However, you got to press a little farther, because then you also have to say, well, where did they get their definition of their God? And lo and behold, you find that it's a man-made definition, and that's different from our definition of our God.
If we had this big category called theism, and that would be a theistic worldview, that is still a category so broad that in order to accurately understand a person's worldview, you've got to ask additional questions.
And that's why Dr. Sayre, I'm sure, keeps going to break it down into five or more. Yes, indeed.
Let's talk about that naturalistic worldview. Is this the worldview that the average college student is going to meet when they go away and sit in the classroom at university?
Oh, I wouldn't say just the college student. I think the game's almost all over by that time. And here's why. The fact that American education, and let's keep in mind that 9 American students out of 10 are still educated by the state. And those 9 out of 10 students are now by law confronted with an education that isn't allowed to mention God in any serious way. So, yes, by the time a student has been involved in an education of that sort for 5 or 6 years, if not less, why would he or she ever think that God did anything important if all the important stuff of life is being taught without any reference to God?
So they're sitting in a classroom, say, throughout all of their elementary and secondary education, and the mere fact that God is not mentioned or discussed, even in the most general sense, forms their worldview.
Absolutely. And see, people say, well, I can see how that might have something to do with science, in that we talk about origins. And they forget that it also has to do with history, and it has to do with literature, and it has to do with language, and it has to do with mathematics. And everything that a child picks up ultimately is either focused on God or focused somewhere else.
Do we recognize our worldviews? Is it something that everyone can articulate?
Oh, no, it's probably too abstract, and even for those of us who like to cogitate on it, I suppose it would be a whole lot better if we brought it back to the here and now and related it to literature and language and mathematics and tied it to very specific things that we deal with every day.
How do I then go about diagnosing what my worldview is? I will accept the fact that I've got one. I am only passingly aware of some of its elements. How do I figure out what my worldview really is? And, more importantly, whether or not it is a worldview that accurately shows me the world around me.
Well, you mentioned that you're going to be taking up a little bit of George Barna's research in the next hour or so on your program. And I think that something Barna did a couple of years ago is most telling in this respect. This is approximately what he found. He asked the question of people who call themselves evangelical Christians. He said, can you point to some decision that you have made in the last 6 months, some decision you have made about something in your life? It might have to do with finance or education or your marriage or your children or your job or your recreation, any facet of your life, some decision that you have made that you made differently because you are a Christian. Now, I think that's a good test of a worldview. Did you make any important decision in any facet of your life did you make it differently because you're a Christian? And Barna found that only 8% of evangelical Christians could point to anything in the previous 6 months that had been affected by their Christian faith. Now, I would say they are not exercising their Christian worldview.
So let's talk about that. Is there such a thing as a uniquely Christian worldview?
Yes, but I think we really, really have to be careful at that point, because I guess the older I get, the more I think it has to do with the process, and I don't want to sound relativistic here, but I think it does have to do with the process, and we've got to be careful not to make it into a formula. We've got to be careful not to predict exactly what God is going to do with any particular one of us as we think things through. The process, though, is one where we constantly have to ask ourselves the question, what is a biblical perspective on this issue? And boy, let's ask that question modestly. Let's ask it carefully. Let's be reluctant to be cocksure and arrogant about our position. On the other hand, let us say with certainty that God does have a perspective on every last bit of his creation.
It is sometimes, if one listens to, I guess you would say kind of the kitchen table conversation of American evangelicalism, you might get the impression that the Christian worldview, the biblical worldview, is coterminous with an American worldview or a conservative American worldview. What do you think about this?
Well, I don't believe that. On the other hand, when somebody says, you've got to be careful, God isn't a Republican or a Democrat, I have to agree with that, of course, because he is so much vaster than any of our systems. At the same time, God is very much interested in what the Republican platform has to say as opposed, let's say, to the Democratic platform. And he is interested in the specifics, the specific positions that we map out. And I don't think we should hesitate to say that for all the faults of particular systems, and conservatism is full of faults, republicanism is full of faults, Americanism is full of faults, nonetheless, those categories of thinking, I think, coincide very often with biblical values, and we shouldn't hesitate to say that.
And I imagine you would also say at the same time we shouldn't hesitate to point out where the conservative worldview or the American worldview conflict with the biblical worldview.
Oh, absolutely. And let me say this loud and clear. I think that secular conservatism is just as much a dead end as secular liberalism. The fuse may take just a little longer to burn, but it's still any kind of secularity that chooses to either ignore God or minimize his role is a deadly, deadly exercise.
We're talking with Joel Beltz. He's publisher and founder of World Magazine. He's going to be speaking at a conference this Friday and Saturday at Center Grove Presbyterian Church in Edwardsville on the issue of worldviews. You can check out World Magazine on the web at worldmag.com, worldmag.com. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Joel, why does it matter? Why is it important? I mean, someone might argue, my grandpappy went through his whole life. He worked, he took care of his family, he served his country, and he went to his grave and never would have used the word worldview or even understood that he had one. Why does it matter that we know today what it is and why we have it?
I suppose in the year 2004, we have to be a little more aware. No, we should be a lot more aware how radically different the world around us is than it was for our parents and our grandparents. And I don't want to imply for a second that back in, you know, that the 1950s were a golden age for Christians or for America, for that matter. But there was, perhaps it was a little more accurate half a century ago to say that we lived in a twisted and off-kilter culture, whereas now I think more and more we have inherited an upside-down culture, and there is a difference.
Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Talking with Joel Beltz about worldviews. Claire is calling from High Ridge. Claire, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor Todd. I just was wondering, in this line of thinking with world views and world Christian views, if the present problem, concern, discussion of this lady in Florida who is they're discussing whether removing her tube feeding or not, whether this is considered a world Christian view or world view that we Christians need to be speaking up about.
Thank you very much, Claire. She makes reference to Terry Schindler Schiavo and the story that, of course, has been brewing for the better part of 2 years in Florida. her husband, Terry Schindler Schiavo's husband, who's also her legal guardian, is seeking to have the food and hydration removed from his wife, and the parents are seeking to have the food and hydration retained. Is this a worldview situation?
Oh, I think it certainly is. I happen to think this is one where even evangelical Christians, Bible-believing Christians, might seriously differ. And I think this is one where, while we applaud and sincerely applaud those who want to uphold life, I think we also need to see the importance of recognizing God as the sovereign giver and taker of life. And I question how quick we should be to judge on this particular issue. And I know some people will not be happy with me for saying that.
One of the things that occurred to me, and it at first does not present itself as a worldview issue, but I'm thinking about the situation that's happening in the Roman Catholic Church with certain bishops in the Roman Catholic Church saying, look, the way that Roman Catholics vote really does matter, and on the issue of life, Roman Catholics ought to vote, consciously vote, for life, and that Roman Catholic lawmakers ought to be warned not to legislate against life. Is this also in the purview of worldviews?
Oh, doesn't everything having to do with the giving and the taking of life, it goes right to the core of our worldview, and incidentally, to the core of our early political documents, where life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness were among the early guarantees. But surely, you know, whether we are talking about the abortion controversy or the end-of-life issues, as in the case in Florida, or capital punishment, one's view of life is central, and we'd better get it straight as biblical Christians.
One of the things that Roman Catholic situation tells me loud and clear, Joel, is that not only the Roman Catholic Church, but the church generally in America has been late to the party, the worldview party, and are only now beginning to realize that many of the people sitting in the pews do not share a Christian worldview, that there are a lot of serious anomalies there in the average evangelical's or even Roman Catholic's worldview vis-a-vis what their church is teaching.
Well, that's why I brought up earlier the issue of education, and I'm bold to bring it up again, because I don't know why we should predict otherwise if people spend 1 or 2 hours a week being instructed by their church and 30 or 40 or 50 hours a week being instructed by the educational establishment, and then entertained for another 15 or 20 hours a week by an entertainment industry that disdains any biblical values. Well, why should we be surprised if they end up with a worldview that is millions of miles away from a biblical one?
Another place where perhaps we might be still playing catch-up is that people who hold a Christian worldview, who consciously hold a biblical worldview, have for the better part of the 20th century been fighting against modernism, the naturalistic worldview, where there was objective truth. But that objective truth, according to naturalism, was accessible only through our senses and through experimentation. The supernatural was pretty much ruled out. Now,
and so we might add to the educational establishment and the entertainment establishment, and I neglected to use the big secular media, we might add to all of them even the mainline denominations who treated people to two or three generations of such modernistic thinking.
You're absolutely right. Well, now we live in a postmodern world, or rapidly becoming one, where there is no absolute truth, where everything, morals and truth itself, truths, are now spoken of in the plural as so many opinions.
At least they like to talk about it that way. I suppose if you stepped up to them and took their wallet away from them, they would come up with some absolute truth pretty fast. Or if you smacked them in the face, they would let you know that they do believe in some things pretty absolutely. You know, it's neat to talk about that in the abstract. It doesn't work so well in real life.
Is that, in a sense, a wedge that the Christian worldview has, in that it corresponds to reality, it accepts absolute truth as a reality, and it's got truth on its side. It's got reality on its side.
Oh, let's pray that biblical believers are able to frame the argument that way, that we can, in simple and loving ways, show people the utter practicality of what God has outlined for us in the scriptures. It's not a fancy theory. It's a real life worldview. It really works.
Joel Belts is publisher and founder of World Magazine. He will be speaking at a conference this Friday and Saturday at Center Grove Presbyterian Church in Edwardsville on the issue of worldviews. For more information on this worldview conference, call Center Grove Presbyterian Church at area code 618-656-9485. That's 618-656-9485, or visit their website, www.centergrove.org. That's centergrove.org. Joel, thanks for being our guest.
It's wonderful to be with you in St. Louis.
Joel Belts, publisher and founder of World Magazine. When we come back from this break, we're going to turn our attention to another worldview. It is a theistic worldview, without a doubt, a world religion, and perhaps the biggest issue facing the Western world at this particular time, and that is Islam. As a religion, as a political system, yesterday we talked with Dr. Schmidt about the union of mosque and state in the religion of Islam, how there is no distinction nor separation between mosque and state. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking about whether or not Islam is a religion of peace. We did hear President George W. Bush recently say that. Actually, I don't know that he said it so recently, but he did say it on several occasions. Is it true that Islam is peace, that Islam is a religion of peace? Dr. Alvin Schmidt of Illinois College and author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West, will be our guest right after this break. And then in the second hour of the program, we will discuss divorce with Dr. David Adams of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. George Barna is reporting that born-again Christians, that inner circle, the inner sanctum of evangelicals that he likes to study so much, that they are divorcing at precisely the same rate as the general population and as non-Christians. What do we make of this? How do we get to the point where even, according to Barna's looking at it, the Christians among the Christians are divorcing at the same rate and are as likely to have failed marriages through divorce? What does the Bible really teach about divorce? Is it something that we can disregard now because the divorce rate is so alarmingly high? It would simply be unworkable. It would simply be impractical to try and operate according to a scriptural view of divorce. We'll also be talking in the course of that conversation a bit about how the church does rightly deal with divorce. Then in the third hour of the program, Dr. David Maxwell will join us. Today, the church remembers Jerome. Now, if you know anything about Jerome, you probably know something about the Latin Vulgate, his translation of Holy Scripture into Latin. Extremely influential. If there were giants in the history of the Christian church, you would put Jerome as one of the mountain peaks there. We're going to be talking about him in the third hour of the program. Then in the last 25 minutes, we will discuss presidential debates, their history, and why they are important, if so, with Dr. Jeff Walsh of Concordia University in Wisconsin. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
As we celebrate mothers this month, we especially want to honor all those mothers who, facing an unplanned pregnancy, generously chose to give life to their little ones.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Even though we live in a culture of so-called choice, often it's difficult for a woman to actually choose life for her unborn child. Many mothers are overcome with fear and in need of emotional or material support. So in addition to honoring mothers this month, let's celebrate the pregnancy resource organizations that assist so many women through unplanned pregnancies, showing them what a celebration motherhood actually is.
The Susan B. Anthony List is dedicated to supporting pro-life legislation, training candidates and activists, and promoting pro-life leaders. To view all this month's commentaries, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Sitting down to a meal of rice and wheat, that's the food many people survive on in the Indian state of Bihar. But this Global Minute focuses on their spiritual needs, so you'll pray for them. Technology is booming and bringing new careers to many people in India. Yet in Bihar State, there are many village-based farmers who live on the same crops their ancestors lived on, such as fruits, nuts, and barley. They work the dirt with their hands in the same way, too. They're called the Bhojpuri Biharis, and the Global Prayer Digest magazine lets us know they're spiritually impoverished, too. They worship millions of different gods and believe good and evil spirits control their lives. Pray for the 36 million Bhojpuri Biharis to hear about Christ and his power over evil. Learn about basic Hindu beliefs and see suggestions on how to pray for Hindus by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. It's a resource for you and your church. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. 10 commandments for this season. The first commandment, thou shalt not pause to plan thy ways, so that thy only goal will be to make it to the 26th. The second commandment, thou shalt feel obligated to blanket the world with thy Christmas cards, much as snow covereth the earth. The third, thou shalt deny the simplicity of Christ's stable by impressing guests with thy holiday house. The fourth, thou shalt not be like the shepherds and show up in the same old clothes. The fifth commandment, thou shalt think thyself a wise man or woman by searching far and wide for gifts. The sixth, thou shalt blow the budget, imagining that thus it will go well with thee. The seventh commandment, thou shalt so stress thyself that thy family calleth thee Scrooge. The eighth commandment, thou shalt be so busy that thou sittest not by the Christmas tree to ponder thy need for this season. The ninth commandment, thou shalt not lay aside old grudges, even while singing of peace and goodwill for all. And the tenth commandment, thou shalt forget the real reason for this season. I'm Dale Meyer.
On the next Focus on the Family.
We're not going to be home the rest of our lives. I'm sure that when our children are of, you know, a certain age that we feel they're ready, we'll go back to work. This isn't permanent. But our children are.
Dr. James Dobson talks to Zarette Beard and a panel of guests about the importance of being a stay-at-home mom. We're focusing on parenting this month on Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
These acts of violence against innocents violate the fundamental tenets of the Islamic faith. And it's important for my fellow Americans to understand that. The English translation is not as eloquent as the original Arabic, but let me quote from the Quran itself. In the long run, evil in the extreme will be the end of those who do evil, for that they rejected the signs of Allah and held them up to ridicule. The face of terror is not the true faith of Islam. That's not what Islam is all about. Islam is peace.
That's President George W. Bush speaking less than a week after the September 11th terrorist attacks at the Islamic Center of Washington, D.C., saying what he said several times before but hasn't said so much recently, that Islam is peace. He even cited a passage from the Quran. Well, is Islam a religion of peace? We're going to be talking about that here in this 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. with Dr. Alvin Schmidt. He's professor emeritus of sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville and author of the new book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. This is part 10, second to last part of our 11-part daily series with him on Islam. Today we take up the question, is Islam a religion of peace? Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Thank you.
The question I put to you, is Islam a religion of peace?
No, definitely not. I wish it were. Chapter 10 in my book is titled Islam, a Religion of Peace, with a question mark behind it, and then I go on and show from the Quran, from the Hadith, from the Sharia, from historical examples, citing not just those sources, but also some Muslims, for example. Ali Bhutto, who once was Prime Minister of Pakistan, says, I know no religion as oppressive as mine. Now, that's from a person that was a Muslim himself. And, you know, I also cite, for example, Irshad Manji, the Muslim woman in Toronto, Canada, in her book that came out a little over a year ago, The Trouble with Islam, says, and let me just read from what she says, pick a Muslim country, any Muslim country, and the most brutal humiliations grab you by the vitals. In Pakistan, an average of 2 women every day die from so-called honor killings, often with Allah's name on the lips of their killers. In Mali and Mauritania, little boys are seduced into slavery by Muslim hustlers. In Sudan, slavery happens at the hands of Islamic militias. In Yemen and Jordan, Christian humanitarian workers have been shot point blank. In Bangladesh, artists who advocate for the rights of the religious minorities have been locked up or driven out of the country entirely. And then she says, it's all documented. Indeed it is. And other sources like that could be cited as well. And I do in this chapter. If readers, you know, want to look at all the details, it's found there. No, it's not a religion of peace. It never has been. It's been violent from the days of Muhammad himself, who himself said, I am the last of the prophets and am sent with the sword. And his followers or successors have been in the same footsteps as he was.
So how has the misperception, we cannot lay this at George W. Bush's doorstep, because he was simply repeating not only what he had been told, but also repeating what was conventional wisdom. How has the misperception arisen that Islam is essentially a peaceful religion?
Yeah, it's an interesting question and a good question. As best as I can determine, it's largely a relatively recent phenomenon. When one looks back only 20, 30 years back, you can't find that. And I think it has a lot to do with political correctness, the attitude of multiculturalism in our society that says all cultures are essentially equal, and political correctness says you may not criticize another culture regardless of what it does. That's the only explanation I can come up with, but it does not have a long history, and it couldn't have been because you have to ignore the facts. And it's strange, for example, when people I say this. I say at the end of the chapter in a paragraph that I think might be of some help. In regard to Islam being a religion of peace and that only a few radical Muslims are the problem, columnist Don Fetter has recently written a telling statement, one that every governmental leader in the West and all freedom-loving Westerners seriously need to ponder. I quote him now. Imagine, in 1940, Winston Churchill taking to the airwaves to announce that Nazism was an ideology of peace, which regrettably had been perverted by a few fanatics like Hitler and Goebbels. But most stormtroopers and SS men are fine fellows, your friends and your neighbors. That's a terrific statement saying, hey, listen, the parallel is very similar to what we're hearing. If we said this about the Nazis, where would we have been? And you might say, given what we're saying about Islam being a religion of peace, where might we be?
This is a reality, as you pointed out in your first response, Dr. Schmidt, that affects not only people outside of Islam, but those within Islam. And before we talk about the two-sided violent aspect of Islam, respond to the counter-criticism that is also popularly heard, and that is that the Christian scriptures, the Old Testament in particular, also teach violence.
Yeah, that's an old saw, and it's kind of a red herring which leads people off the track, so to speak, which is what red herring really means. Well, there are a couple of responses to that, and I address them in the book as well. First of all, the violence that one finds in the Old Testament is about 3,000 years old. In addition to that, not one of the Old Testament prophets, whether it was Isaiah, Jeremiah, Malachi, or whoever he was, Amos, ever advocated the use of violence or the sword. None of them. The only so-called prophet that does was Muhammad. In addition to that, Israel today, even in its conflicts with the Palestinians, never cites the Old Testament passages to justify its violence, if you will, in terms of most of them, many times it's a matter of defense, in justifying what it's doing. We in the Christian as well as in the Jewish community see those passages in the Old Testament all in the past tense, 3,000 years ago. In addition to that, the New Testament does not have one remote passage that justifies violence. And so when they say that, the Bible also teaches violence, yeah, in part that's true, but it's 3,000 years old and we don't live by that ethic anymore. Christians certainly don't. We live under the ethic of the New Testament, and even Jews do not live under that ethic anymore. So it's a major fallacy, and I'm afraid it often trips up a lot of people.
When you say past tense, I want to make sure that we're not misunderstood here. You are not discounting the Old Testament in toto. It sounds as though what you're saying is the Old Testament injunctions toward violence were for a particular people at a particular time in a given circumstance. In other words, even for ancient Israel, they were not given carte blanche to destroy their enemies,
exactly,
say, outside of outside of the time of the conquest.
You said it very well. Exactly right. No, that's quite true.
Let's contrast that with what we find in the Quran, in the Hadith, and in the Sharia sayings about violence and what it calls for.
Yeah, they're all in the present tense, every one of them. And, for example, as I point out, if Islam is a religion of peace, I ask 6-7 questions. I might repeat them. Why is it then a capital crime in most Islamic countries to make critical or negative comments about Muhammad or to question the Quran? 2, why have so many writers, especially former Muslims, who have written works critical of Islam, had their lives threatened, forcing them in many instances to have guards adopt pseudonyms and keep their addresses secret? 3, how does one explain the words of Irshad Manji that I read just a little while ago? By the way, she, as having written that book, she lives in a house that is bulletproof now with a guard. Now, is that an example of religion of peace, even in Toronto, Canada? 4, how does one explain the comment by Oriana Fallaci, whom I quote from one of her books, quote, from Afghanistan to Sudan, from Palestine to Pakistan, from Malaysia to Iran, from Egypt to Iraq, from Algeria to Senegal, from Syria to Kenya, from Libya to Chad, from Lebanon to Morocco, from Indonesia to Yemen, from Saudi Arabia to Somalia, the hate of the West swells like a fire fed in the wind, end of quote. 5, why have the jihad passages in the Quran not been abrogated under the Islamic so-called doctrine of abrogation? You know, as a doctrine of abrogation, the passages can be changed. They have not been. Why not? 6, why, as Robert Spencer, whom I cite, has noted, who's written a couple of books on the topic, are there no verses in the Quran or Hadith that mitigate the violent passages? There are none. 7, finally, 2 additional questions asked by a former Muslim Shiite Islamist are pertinent. If Islam is a peaceful religion, why are there so many verses in the Quran about killing the infidels and those who resist Islam? He goes on to say, if Islam is peaceful, why isn't there even one Muslim country that will allow freedom of religion and speech? End of quote. I think those are pretty telling arguments, and this last one is by a former Muslim.
What are these two terms, Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb?
Yeah, well, you see, that's another example to cite that Islam's not a religion of peace. Dar al-Islam means the house or field of Islam, where Islam pervades and exists. Dar al-Harb is the opposite, the house or field of war that needs to be conquered by Muslims to make it Islamic as well. Now, these are two basic concepts in Muslim theology or ideology. They're rarely mentioned, but they, again, violate the whole idea that Islam is a religion of peace. It's only peaceful once it has total control.
Someone says, now wait, that those concepts, Dar al-Islam, Dar al-Harb, the world of Islam, the world of war, those are ideas of radical Muslims.
Yeah, well, you know, that's another example. What's a radical Muslim that we typically hear? And I address that particular question. Is it even a valid concept? We hear a lot in the media about it, you and I, ever since September 11. And I ask a few questions. First, what distinguishes a radical Muslim from those who are not radical? Do radical Muslims believe in the Quran and see Muhammad as their prophet, whereas the non-radical Muslims do not? From all indications, they both believe in the Quran and see Muhammad as Islam's prophet. Second, do a radical Muslim fully believe and totally commit themselves to the teachings of the Quran and the Hadith? On the other hand, do non-radical Muslims not fully believe and not fully commit themselves to the teachings of the Quran and the Hadith? If the answer is to both questions is yes, then the radical Muslims are truly true-believing Muslims, and the non-radical Muslims are only nominal Muslims. And that's a very important point to make. As there are nominal Christians, there are nominal Muslims. And so if you want to contrast them to that, you might even say they might not even be Muslims. Third, if radical Muslims are those who engage in terror and killing of innocent people, then in order to be consistent, the definition must include Muhammad. Given the prevailing concept of radical Muslims, he certainly fits the definition. He was Islam's first warrior. History shows he ordered numerous massacres and even killed some individuals himself. I document that even in the earlier part of the book. Another argument, how does the concept of radical Muslims become radical? Is it because the Quran and the Hadith and the Sharia contain radical concepts, precepts? As one authority on Islam has recently said, quote, informed Muslims know that the Quran does not advocate moderation, end quote. And I have one more argument. The concept of radical Muslims as used by the media and politicians implies that these Muslims are only a small minority. That's not true either. For example, it's been estimated that minimally there are 150 million members in various terror groups today. That's hardly a minority. And so, but that again is a, I don't know what you want to call it. It's a deceptive device either used intentionally or ignorant to convey the idea that Islam is a religion of peace. But it's hard to find a passage in the Bible, in the Quran, that says there is peace. It's just not there.
You're listening to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Islam in this, the 10th of our 11-part series on Islam. Answering the question, is Islam a religion of peace, with Dr. Alvin Schmidt. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Tim, who calls from his car. Tim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I had a quick question because your guest made mention that there's no Old Testament prophet that advocated the use of the sword. I hope I'm not misquoting him there, but I get beat up now and then because of the Amalekites and the order to destroy that nation. You know, I'm told, how can God make such an order to destroy an entire race, men, women, and children?
Tim, it's a great question. Thank you very much.
I mean, how could God do that? Well, first of all, he didn't do it through a prophet, did he?
Tim is no longer with us.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Okay, can you reword the question?
Well, the question that he asked is, how do you respond when someone says, look, there are passages in there where God commands the ancient Israelites to, say, take out an entire nation or entire group of people like the Amalekites?
Well, yeah. As I think I was trying to say a little while ago, maybe I didn't say it clear enough. How and why God did that is usually explained in terms of, the context very often itself. They were godless people. God was trying to protect the nation of Israel, if you want to use that term. At least it wasn't the term used then, but the people of Israel, rather. And we leave it at that. At the same time, we have to remember that that particular ethic has been changed entirely with Jesus Christ, who never advocated violence. And Christianity, for 300 years, when it was violently persecuted, never ever retorted in kind. So I have to say this again, although it was true in the past, it is not true in the present. With the Quran, it is true in the present. It is not in the past tense. So when we say Islam is a religion of peace, it's not true because the present tense denies it. And likewise, if we were to say, for example, Christianity and Judaism is a religion of violence, it would not be true because presently they're not operating under that ethic or that norm.
Well, in about 10 minutes, folks, you might want to stay tuned because we have here in Studio A and slated to talk for the next hour on the issue of divorce, Dr. David Adams, who's an Old Testament scholar. And I'll spend the first few minutes with it in that, second hour conversation. Getting his response also to Tim's question as well. Let's talk with Joe, who calls from his car. Joe, welcome.
Hi. I caught the part where you all said that Islam would, there's no peace until it's in total control. And I've been wondering about this for a while, just what their objective is. Like, if you took Islam as a whole, what do they want from the world? Because it's obvious that they want to be, they want to have it all to themselves, I think, by their actions. But, I guess I just wonder if you'd care to speculate on how they see a perfect world, if it was as they want it to be. And then this may be getting too far off the topic, but just their motivation for this, I guess when I look at what they do, I find it hard to believe that this is really religiously motivated. I mean, it seems to me that it comes down to, you know, they see the rest of the world prosper from a democratic system or capitalist system, and they're jealous of it, but they won't embrace it, so they hate us for it. Like, the leadership in those countries has to have a scapegoat, and it's always the Western world.
Joe, thank you very much for the call. Let's see what we can do with his question. Can we look objectively at the writings of Islam, and can we determine if there is a goal, in fact, a global goal, for this as a religion?
Well, I think so. When you look at some of the violent passages that are advocated in the Quran, it clearly indicates to fight them until there is no more resistance, until there's no more persecution. Persecution meaning an enemy that resists you. I think that's pretty clear. So I think that's the answer.
And as to Joe's question of whether or not this could be religiously motivated, maybe it's just greed, maybe it is jealousy. What do you think? Is this a religious motivation? Or, as the president has said, no, this is just a totalitarian political mindset.
It's not just political. It, long before it was political, it was religious. Let me illustrate. When right after, 2 years after, Muhammad died, and he died in 632, his successor, Bakr, then invaded, and his successor 2 years after that began to invade and conquer all of the eastern countries east of the Mediterranean, the northern part of Africa. And what motivated them to go into Spain? It was minding its own business in 711 and conquered it, killed hundreds and thousands of them, destroyed churches and the like, persecuted not only the Christians but also Jews, and were there for almost 800 years. There was little communication. They simply wanted to conquer. What motivated them to go on then into France at the Battle of Poitiers, or Tours, as it's called, 100 miles within Paris, when Charles Martel finally beat them? Had they not lost that, the whole Western world would today be dominated, Europe, by Islam. And so, no, it wasn't the hatred at the point. It was a matter of going out, reaching, conquering, spreading their wings, so to speak, to take over and put forth the Islamic religion, because that's the goal.
Let's go to several other callers, see as many as we can get in here in the last few minutes. Dennis, our time is very, very short. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Very well.
I'd like to corroborate, you know, what your speaker is saying. I've studied Islam for 20, 25 years. You know, there are contradictory statements in there, and I'm sure he can validate this also, where it talks about the Jews and Christians, you know, being closest to you in friendship and kinship, and those who are righteous people. But then there are others that say the Jews and Christians are your sworn enemies. You know, so, you know, that inconsistency, I know that some of those surahs were written at different times. I believe that the later surahs were the ones where Jews and Christians were considered enemies, if that's true. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Dennis. Dr. Schmidt.
Yeah, that's quite correct. I mean, it's in one place it tells you that Christians and Jews are to be your enemies and not to make a friend of them in the Quran, and the other place it contradicts. The Quran is full of contradictions. I would say, however, when it comes to advocating violence, there is no contradiction. It's very consistent on that.
Very briefly, Ed, calling from Chesterfield. Thank you for calling. Welcome.
Thank you. Yes, I want to ask the doctor, are there any Islamic-controlled countries in the world today whose governments are not controlled by the Islamic radicals or terrorists?
Thank you.
Well, yeah, to some extent, they're not that powerfully, they don't have that much control in Turkey, for example. That's probably the best example to cite.
What about Saudi Arabia, where there is a kind of a monarchical family rule, and some people differ on whether or not the families themselves, the Saud family, is radical in their Islamic outlook?
Well, Saudi Arabia basically is the Wahhabism type of Islam, which is linked with the Al-Qaeda philosophy. So, yeah, it's the more extreme, if you want to use that term.
Now, Dr. Schmidt, we would like to be able to have in our last installment with you, part 11 on Monday, on Islam. We'd like to have enough time to take all our phone calls. Would you be willing to do an hour with us?
Yes, be pleased to do so.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt, thank you for being our guest.
Yeah, my pleasure again.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville. He has authored this book, upon which we are basing our series, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam, and The Triumph of the West. You can purchase this book on the web at Amazon.com. $5 off the regular price, by the way. The book is called The Great Divide, Amazon.com, or you can call toll-free Regina Orthodox Press. It's 1-800-636-2470, 1-800-636-2470. On Monday, we're going to be talking with Dr. Schmidt, kind of wrapping all of this up, this 11-part series, but we're going to talk about Islam's best friends. He says there are two, political correctness and Islamic apologists. Will respond to some of the arguments that are made by Islamic apologists. It will be a great summary for our series on Islam with Dr. Schmidt. When we come back from this break, an entire hour with Dr. David Adams here in Studio A, George Barna has recently reported that born-again Christians are as likely to divorce as non-Christians. George Barna's research is generally very trustworthy, and he has a vested interest in this inner circle group called born-again Christians. How can it be that the Christians among Christians are divorcing at the same rate as non-Christians? Has the teaching of divorce failed in the Christian church? And if so, let's revisit the teaching of divorce. What does the Bible have to say about divorce? More often than not, I think Christians are confused. They say, well, is there such a thing as a biblical divorce? Is all divorce a sin? Is divorce the unforgivable sin? What do we do with the Old Testament teachings of divorce as opposed to the New Testament teachings of divorce? And how do we interpret the famous words from Malachi, the second chapter, where God says very plainly through the prophet, I hate divorce? It'll also occasion a brief conversation on marriage as well. And we'll start with that question about Islam with Dr. David Adams when we come back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.